From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, we take a look at the skyrocketing number of homeless families in San Francisco.
There was very little housing developed over the last 10 years for homeless families. We have families stuck in the shelter system, going through a process, reaching their time limit, and then having to enter back in. And then we have all these new families becoming homeless.
Also, we'll consider ways to keep families from foreclosing.
Loan servicers can modify people's loans and reduce the principal so that what they owe is more in line with what the value of their house is.
And we'll hear what a high school student thinks of gentrification in the Mission District.
The Mission, I remember, was loud, full of life, out on the street. And now all that feels like it's gone.
That and more coming up on Cross Currents. When you think of homelessness in San Francisco, your first mental image might be of what's visible. People huddled in blankets in the Tenderloin, panhandling in the Upper Haight, or making camp in Golden Gate Park. But those individuals don't paint the whole picture. Nationally, at least 35% of the homeless population is made up of families with children who can't very safely spend the night outdoors. It's not much different in San Francisco. In fact, the number of families who've put their names on San Francisco's shelter waiting list is higher than ever. According to Compass Family Services, it's breaking all records now at 264 families. 5 years ago, the waiting list was less than a third as long. So why is this happening now, and what can the city do about it? KALW's Sarah Bernard reports.
In 2002, Adrian Allen was working a good-paying job in construction.
I went to school for construction, graduated, top of my class. I was the only female on an all-men's crew.
But then she developed thoracic outlet syndrome, a rare condition that creates terrible pain in the neck and shoulder, and she was left unable to work. After cycling through four or five less physically demanding positions, she was eventually forced to go on disability.
And times got hard to where I couldn't afford the utilities anymore. It had just gotten so bad that it was no way that I could live like that any longer. I have lived in the dark for several months. I have gone without water for almost 2 years, hot water rather. You know what I mean? So it was really hard.
Allen, a native San Franciscan, is 43 years old. She mostly raised her four children in Modesto. These days, three of them are able to support themselves, but the other is only 11 years old.
If it was me by myself, I can do this by myself, but I have somebody that I'm responsible for.
Allen and her son, who are staying with a friend for now, are one of over 250 families on the waiting list for shelter at Compass Connecting Point. It's a program of Compass Family Services that helps families find temporary housing in San Francisco. The Compass waiting room is often filled with families, not only seeking shelter, but also access to other resources like computers, food, clothing, and counseling.
We went up 22 families in a week.
Elizabeth Anker is Assistant Program Director at Compass Connecting Point. She says the number of families on the list has been shooting up, especially in the past few months.
We're not sure exactly why that happened. I started working at Connecting Point back in 2006, and there were 76 families on the waiting list at that point. So you can see the numbers have increased pretty significantly.
And about 60% of the families on the list right now have never been homeless before. Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness, explains.
The huge piece is the recession, of course, and so for very low-income families who are spending most of their income on rent, when they lose hours, when they lose jobs, it's really destabilizing because they have very little cush. They have nothing to fall out back on. They have no accumulated wealth, and that ends up leading to homelessness.
Friedenbach says San Francisco's shortage of affordable housing is also contributing to the crisis.
There was very little housing developed over the last 10 years for homeless families. We have families stuck in the shelter system, going through a process, reaching their time limit, and then having to enter back in. And then we have all these new families becoming homeless.
Recently, the focus in San Francisco has been on homeless single adults.
The reason for that is very political. So when you have the most kind of visible population out on the streets, the politicians want to really focus on them to reduce them because homeless families are very invisible. So that doesn't create a lot of political will to address the problem.
Compass's Elizabeth Anker says not being able to rely on social services forces many families to seek their own solutions.
We see a lot of families that are doubled up in the project, so maybe there will be 9 or 10 people staying in a one-bedroom apartment in the Bayview.
Those situations can be unsustainable, but even when desperate families seek short-term emergency shelter, they're being turned away.
We're not really sure what to do from here.
Demand is just too high.
Providence Shelter had their first turn away ever a couple weeks ago, which has never, ever happened. And then the Oshun Center, which is not even a shelter, but a drop-in center for women and families, has actually filled up for the first time as well. And families are reporting that they have to stay there during the day if they want to keep their spot during the night.
The wait time for long-term shelter placement is at least 6 months, sometimes as long as 9 months. Jennifer Friedenbach says the time spent in transition can be devastating.
You have parents that have to separate from their children. You have people moving around from place to place to place, staying with friends here and there, people living in their cars, folks living in garages, folks having to stay in very unsafe situations that normally they would not be a part of because they don't have any other place to live.
Adrian Allen and her son are staying with a friend right now, which is at least something, but that has its challenges too.
I've been gone a long time and living on my own a long time, and to have to come back and be thrust to stay in someone else's house with your child, and you got to deal with what they want you to deal with in their house. So I need to get out and be in my own situation where I can raise my son the way he's supposed to be raised. He's ready to move. He's ready to move on. Mm-hmm. He says it every day. I'm ready to go, Mom. It's time to go. So I'm doing what I have to do to try to make that possible.
That's probably the goal of every single family on the waiting list. But it might take months or years before it happens. In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Bernard for Cross Currents.
One of the people you just heard, Jennifer Friedenbach, says the Coalition on Homelessness has been trying to schedule a face-to-face meeting with San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee, but it's been unsuccessful so far. She says she wants to share some ideas on how the city can act right now to help families waiting for shelter.
They could expand the local rental subsidy for families that San Francisco has pretty quickly. We can get 50 families into housing through that. We could open up all these vacant units that are government-owned units through the San Francisco Housing Authority and prioritize families to move into those.
Those are some solutions from Jennifer Friedenbach of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. What are your suggestions? Call us with your ideas and leave them on our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Josephine Tolbert lost her home just a couple of weeks ago.
I was living here at 150 Ankeny Street since 1972. I opened my daycare here in 1995. I started off with eight.
Tolbert ran into financial trouble a few years back. She was sued and her daycare temporarily shut down. When she fell behind on her payments, Bank of America sold her home in a short sale to a real estate company called True Compass. That firm evicted the 75-year-old great-grandmother 2 weeks ago, changing the locks in the house while she was out. KALW's Jen Sheehan spoke with Tolbert on the sidewalk in front of her former home, just a few blocks from KALW here in San Francisco's Portola District. The house is locked. A post on the door says no trespassing. But you can still see signs of Tolbert's daycare business through the small lace-curtained windows at the front of the house.
Oh, we have a little table there that we, the kids draw and play little games. And oh, it's a radio in the back that plays little kitty music where they do their little kitty dance. And it's a wonderful daycare. You know, I love it, and the kids love it.
It looks beautiful.
Oh, it is beautiful. I wish you could get in there.
And then you lived upstairs.
I lived upstairs. But you know what makes it so sad? You know, my home was completely paid for in 2002. I did not owe one dime. As soon as I got my home paid for, I had some financial difficulties due to domestic issues that I had to pay out a lump sum of money, $167,000, actually. And then I got sick. I had colon cancer. You know, after all of this was going on, I had colon cancer. I recovered quickly, you know, got back on the road. I paid them off, and I was still trying to hold on to my home. I worked very hard. My original payment, which was with, I can't remember what mortgage company it was. It was like $1,100. And then when it switched over to Countrywide, and from Countrywide, it switched over to Bank of America, and it had gone up double the amount of money that it was originally, and the income was the same. So that had put me into a bad situation. But at the same time, I was steady writing hardship letters and let them know the circumstances of why I was falling behind with my house note. I had hired an attorney. And the attorney that I had hired, I thought, was working with the attorneys with the new owners. True Compass is the name of the investors that had bought the house, and I guess it didn't work out. And I had gone to take the kids out. I'm always picking up and dropping off kids. I got back from taking my granddaughter off to school, as I said before. I came back. When I got here, there was about three or four people standing in front of my house. And they looked. I said, what are you doing? So we changed the lock on your door. I said, you changed the lock on my door? I had just came off, you know, from the Thanksgiving holiday. Oh, I paid you $700 every 7 days. I've given you $1,400 for the last 2 weeks. And I'm coming here, I think Wednesday, whatever day it was after Thanksgiving, and you locking me out of my home. He said, the owners request that you vacate the premises. And I was really kind of stunned at that move. They did not allow me to go in to get my medication. They would not allow me to get the baby's bottles. And the milk that I had, the baby was breastfed. And then I could not get that milk. I could not get any diapers. They told me, you can't go in there. This is our property. It's unfair for someone to just come and take your house. And you worked all of your life. And here I am, 75 years old. Where could I start over again? I can't. You know, I can't pick up like I'm maybe a 20 or 21 and start all over again. And what made me, you know, really upset with the so-called buyers, how they sit up and feel so, you know, like, we got the power. You know, they stand up. I mean, who you think you are, a little aunt? And I'm telling you, I've been a law-abiding citizen all my 75 years and try to be honest, loving, and helping people. And you gonna come here and look at me like you God? No way. You are not God. And you may think you have the power of God, your money may have the power, but you are not. You may be a God. I'm not doubting that, but you're not Almighty God. You know, things like this happen. It makes your self-esteem, you know, just really go down, and it make you feel like a failure, you know, and make you feel like there's no hope. But, you know, I'm a fighter. I'm not too easy, even though I'm 75 years old. I still have a lot of fire, and I'm not too easy to just give in. This lady, I said, okay, this happened, and it's, no. I'm going to find a way to get my house back.
That's Josephine Tolbert. She spoke with KALW's Jen Sheehan. Until recently, Tolbert owned a home in San Francisco's Portola neighborhood. We've requested a response from True Compass, the company that purchased Tolbert's home, and from Bank of America, but we haven't been able to reach anyone yet for a statement. Losing their homes has been a national problem ever since the housing bubble burst, leading the country into recession. A new federal report has revealed that real estate speculation was largely to blame.
I I remember when I lost my mind.
Back in 2006, the economy wasn't bust. It was booming. Investors were snapping up multiple properties with help from the subprime credit market. Researchers from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York have found that more than a third of all U.S. home mortgages handed out in 2006 went to people who already owned a home. In fact, people who owned three or more properties were the fastest growing part of the market. The frenzy drove real estate prices to unprecedented levels. In California, the average home price more than doubled from 2000 to 2006. Fast forward now to today. We've come to know that the subprime credit market was corrupt. That blown-up housing market burst. And while it cost speculators a lot of money, it cost first-time homeowners a lot more. Kevin Stein studies foreclosures, and he's become very busy over the last few years. As associate director of the California Reinvestment Coalition, he fights predatory lending practices and negotiates with banks to keep people in their homes. Stein told me that he thinks lax federal oversight helped create the economic mess we find ourselves in today. That's no surprise. But he also said, despite talk of reform, the Obama administration still isn't doing right by the people. I asked him to lay out the problem and provide us with his solutions.
There are many reasons why it could be occurring. The bank's financial interest is against helping people, or the banks are overwhelmed because they never knew there would be millions of foreclosures, or they've had to hire people so quickly that they have people who don't really know even what the banks want them to be doing, and these are the people making decisions. Whatever the reason, people are suffering as a result of this system being crazy.
What would you do to make this right if you could?
Well, one is around principal reduction. So there are maybe a couple million people in California who are underwater. Loan servicers can modify people's loans and reduce the principal so that what they owe is more in line with what the value of their house is. They're generally not doing that. We did a study in some of the areas in California under the HAMP program. It seems like 5% of the loans where there are modifications include some form of principal reduction. Interestingly, the banks, in the minority of cases, own the loans that they're servicing. Usually, they service loans on behalf of other investors or companies or entities. Banks seem to be more likely to reduce principal when they own the loan, which makes sense that as the owner of the loan, you would rather have someone paying you a little bit less than not paying you at all. Which raises the question, what are they doing for the majority of loans that they don't own? Why aren't they reducing principal? So what I would do is to enforce a mandatory loan modification program that included principal reduction to get people back on track. Another big concern that we have is the issue known as the dual track. So many people now, you know, the main path forward is to try and secure a loan modification. And so borrowers who are struggling will contact their loan servicer. Maybe they'll work with an advocate to help them do that. And while they're submitting all their documents and being diligent and responsible and acting in good faith to try and get the modification, the banks will continue the foreclosure process. And sometimes we will hear stories of people who actually got a letter saying, congratulations, we are offering you a loan modification, but it's after they've already lost their home. So they've lost their home. You know, so
it's like a race.
Yeah, it's like a race. The right hand's not knowing what the left hand is doing. And why? So that's the dual track. Why should we have the dual track? We had a state bill we worked on with allies last year that was just focused on the dual track. And it got killed in the first committee, which was the Senate Banking Committee.
Was the reasoning because the banks still need to look out for their best interest in this, in that if this loan modification does not work out, then they still have to take action to make the foreclosure. And if they slow down the process on one or the other, then they're going to end up losing money?
I think that's a fair representation of their interest. They want to be able to continue the process. I think they say, well, if knowing that the process is going makes the borrower more responsive, they're more worried, we're saying make a decision. Fully consider someone and decide. We're not saying you have to give a modification to everybody. Based on the existing programs, decide if someone qualifies for a modification. And if they do not, then proceed with the foreclosure process. If they do, give them the modification so we don't have people falling through the cracks when they could have been saved. You know, their homes could have been saved. That's a preventable foreclosure. And we shouldn't have that situation. Yeah, so that's a big problem. In terms of, you know, like what in the real world, what should happen? You know, there should be a new, this is maybe more than you want, but we should have, the regulator should be better at making sure the banks, meaning they should do something. They should make sure the banks are accountable for at least following existing laws and rules. We need modifications that are sustainable. It can't be voluntary. It has to be mandatory.
So to summarize your last point, basically, are you saying, well, they should actually do something?
Yes. Unfortunately, we have recalcitrant financial institutions that are affecting people day to day, regulators that are not doing anything about it, and policymakers who seem to be afraid to change the dynamic.
Kevin Stein is Associate Director of the California Reinvestment Coalition. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. San Francisco has one of the tightest rental markets in the country. Competition for housing has gotten so stiff that many landlords are making money just from rental application fees. Another result of all that competition is that it leads neighborhood demographics to change. As wealthier people move in, less affluent ones are forced out. 16-year-old Lupe Hernandez has seen some of those changes in the Mission District. Her family is Mexican, and she produced this commentary about the Latino neighborhood's changing identity.
Living in San Francisco, one becomes familiar with the variety and culture, each one seeming to have its own neighborhood. For Hispanics and Latinos, this neighborhood is the Mission. If you haven't been to the Mission Street in a while, there have been many changes. The biggest change is in the people, Latinos. It seems that the percentage of Latinos has decreased while a new culture has moved in. Most of these movers are the so-called hipsters. It's easy to spot hipsters on the Mission streets. They're usually riding bikes, filling up coffee shops, or buying jewelry from the street vendors by the BART to wear them with something like a suit or a cocktail dress.
I like the way they dress sometimes because other times they look like hobos.
That's my friend Raquel Barajas. Her parents are Mexican and she grew up in San Francisco. Like any other Mexican kid, she spent a lot of time in the Mission with her parents. I asked her what she thought about the hipster culture.
I like their style. I wouldn't dress like them, but I do like their style. It's like different and out there.
I was surprised by her response because to me, hipster culture could easily be seen as a threat to the Latin population in the Mission. Many of the things I remember from growing up there just aren't there anymore. Where I used to see Mexican bakeries, now there are expensive cafes, and most people can't afford that. There used to be a CD store called Ritmo Latino, where everyone would go to hang out. Music was always blasting. Now, it's a cell phone store. When I go to the Mission now, it feels empty. People used to hang out on the street. Now they're all inside dark music venues at night. The Mission I remember was loud, full of life, out on the street. And now all that feels like it's gone. What's worse, people don't even seem to notice. Even some of the Hispanics who still live there. For example, my friend Raquel told me she didn't really notice any difference. She also said that the changes in the neighborhood didn't affect her identity.
If I dress a certain way, I'm still going to be Mexican.
Hearing this made me sad. To me, the Mission was one of the only places where I could experience Hispanic culture. My parents are Mexican, but they don't follow a lot of cultural traditions. At school, no one really listens to Mexican music. It's all about top 40 hip-hop. But when I went to the Mission, Latin music is all I heard. People were always out on the street speaking Spanish. It was full of life, different than most of the places I was in as a kid. Being there felt like walking outside at night and feeling the cold on your cheeks. Hipster culture is different. To me, it seems like the people who live in the Mission now are quieter. They sit in cafes, they don't have kids, and they don't play loud music. Really chill. I see a lot more people in suits with office jobs. I don't have any problem with hipsters. but they've changed how the mission looks and sounds and feels. It's almost a completely new area. I know that cities are always changing, but that doesn't mean it doesn't matter if a culture is isolated. Latin culture made the mission what it is, and I hope that people who live there now don't forget that, whether they're Hispanic and proud of it or not. For Cross Currents, I'm Lupe Hernandez.
Lupe Hernandez is a student at Philip and Sala Burton High School in the Portola, where KALW studios are located. You can find more youth-produced work on our website. That's klwnews.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Yulia Lundgren, Byron McGovern, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Joaquin Palomino, Rena Palta, Stephen Short, and Alexandra Victoria. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. Cross Currents theme music is provided by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. City Carshare provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing is by Mississippi Mike Wolf, a prolific San Francisco singer-songwriter who plays in, as he says, as many bands as it takes to rock your socks off. If you missed his sold-out show at the Great American Music Hall back in the summer, you have a chance to hear him this Saturday, along with Paul Griffiths, at the very intimate Bizarre Cafe on California Street in San Francisco. Music starts about 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffner.
We got our guitars, thought we could be stars, but no way.